Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 545, titled Update on 9/11 and Related Matters. This is being recorded on March 19th of the year 2006. At the conclusion of Side 1, we were talking about an article that appeared in both the Pakistani and Indian press about the cover-up, the considerable bribing campaign that the Pakistani Foreign Office, the equivalent of our State Department, engaged in order to basically prevent some extremely unsavory disclosures about Pakistani involvement in September 11th from coming out. At the very conclusion of that, I gave you a little taste of some of what was actually at least in the mix, so to speak, as far as verifiable information that could have come out into public view had it not been, at least in part, for that Pakistani Foreign Office bribery department, a bribery program, I should say. And we're going to continue with this. Now, one of the most shocking elements of information concerning Pakistani involvement in September 11th, and also a disclosure that stood to tar a great many people within the U.S. power elite and State Department and military as well, was the fact that apparently not only were Pakistani intelligence operatives involved in helping to plan September 11th, this was known to the U.S. in June of 1999 at least, and in the run-up to 2001, or the run-up to September 11th, I should say, there were indications from the information covered in the book we're about to excerpt that people in our own government knew what was coming down, and for whatever reason, probably I suspect a multiplicity of different reasons, some of them at least decided not to act. The book that we covered in For the Record number 500 was a book called The Big Wedding by Sander Hicks. In For the Record 500, I interviewed Sander Hicks. I also interviewed him again in 525, along with one of his assistants, somebody who's helped him in research, that is, a researcher in his own right, Alan Duncan, a former police officer from New York turned social worker. And one of the things that we talked about in For the Record 500 and one of the things spoken about in For the Record 525 and written about by Sander Hicks in The Big Wedding is a meeting between undercover FBI informant Randy Glass and a Pakistani intelligence agent named Rulum R.G. Abbas, or R.G. Abbas. We're going to read a little bit about this meeting that took place in June of 1999, what Abbas had to say, and we're going to take a look at some of the very damning information that might have done a lot of damage to a lot of careers, both in Pakistan and in the United States, had the full story of Pakistani involvement in September 11th come out. Turning to the written description for the Record number 500, which in turn has text excerpted directly from The Big Wedding, we read, at a dinner in June of 1999 at the Tribeca Grill, Randy Glass was wining and dining Rulum G. Abbas, a Pakistani arms dealer, and his friends. Glass and ATF agent Dick Stoltz were posing as weapons brokers as part of a federal sting operation. The Pakistani had close connections to the Pakistani intelligence elite, the ISI. In fact, Glass later told Dateline he believed Abbas was an ISI agent. The Tony Tribeca Grill, owned by Robert De Niro, was just north of the World Trade Center in 1999. Abbas boasted to his dinner companions that he wouldn't have any problem taking out the entire downtown restaurant because it's full of Americans, unquote. Towards the end of the meal, he gestured out towards the Twin Towers. Those towers are coming down, unquote. Later, Randy Glass gave a lot of this information to the Dateline program, but it was not broadcast to any significant extent. Although Glass, continuing with material from The Big Wedding, although Glass told Dateline this story, it wasn't broadcast. The only media to report it was the Palm Beach Post on October 17, 2002. And then quoting from that article, in August 2001, just before Glass started to serve a seven-month sentence for a $6 million jewelry scam, he said he reached out to Senator Bob Graham and U.S. Representative Robert Wexler. He said he told staffers for both lawmakers that a Pakistani operative working for the Taliban, known as R.G. Abbas, made three references to imminent plans to attack the World Trade Center during the probe, which ended in June of 2001. At one meeting at New York's Tribeca Grill caught on tape, Abbas pointed to the World Trade Center and said, quote, "Those towers are coming down," unquote, Glass said. Dateline used Glass in a follow-up piece 5 months later, but still failed to mention the crucial details about Abbas. And then he goes on, that is to say, Sandra Hicks goes on to describe the circumstances surrounding his ability to get Randy Glass on tape, and also more about Pakistani involvement in September 11th. "I was eager to get Randy Glass on INN World Report and go where Dateline and Cy Hirsch feared to tread. R.G. Abbas and the ISI had their paw prints all over 9/11. The Times of India and French news agency AFP had reported that the head of the ISI, General Mahmoud, wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta through Saeed Sheikh right before 9/11. But no U.S. media outlet ever reported this. It was common knowledge that the ISI and the CIA have been in bed together since Afghanistan's Mujahideen Soviet Civil War." Skipping down in the big wedding, Randy Glass, in the run as September 11th approached, Randy Glass attempted to contact people. In fact, he did contact people within officialdom, so to speak, including the State Department, and it was revealed that there were a number of people who knew about the impending attacks, but in order to avoid alienating the Pakistanis, who were a nuclear power at that point, squaring off fairly directly with their longtime belligerent India, the information that Randy Glass was trying to present to people was basically deep-sixed. And in his attempts to alert the State Department, Sandra Hicks writes of Randy Glass as follows. Later, Glass stated that the State Department contact said Musharraf just took over, and our position is that they're a nuclear power, and they've been flexing their nuclear muscles with India, and we're trying to prevent a nuclear catastrophe. And we know about the threat, the terrorist threat from Al-Qaeda, and bin Laden flying airplanes into the World Trade Center. And Musharraf has guaranteed us, because it's his ISI behind it, that we can stop it if we support him publicly. Look, Randy, we know you're a straight guy, so we're going to give you some information. You cannot do two things. You cannot go to the media under any circumstances. We're playing in a nuclear minefield now. Secondly, you can't tell the agents that you're working with now because they're cut out of the loop. They know nothing. And skipping down, Glass, when I called the State Department, I said to them, listen, I already know about the World Trade Center, so they assumed that I knew more than I did, and I didn't. I didn't know anything about airplanes. Hicks, so you bluffed and you kind of pretended you knew more than you did, and then what did they tell you? Glass, but I didn't even have to do that. I just said what I knew. I said, look, listen, I know the World Trade Center is going to be attacked. And then this guy said to me, Randy, listen, you cannot mention any of these things, especially about airplanes being used to fly into the World Trade Center. And when he said that, I almost fell off my bleeping chair. I mean, you have no idea. I thought I was going to wear the tape out. Glass was reticent to talk too specifically about the State Department higher up. But each time, he revealed a little more. Over the course of our talks in December, he revealed that the guy who knew about, quote, planes being flown into the World Trade Center, unquote, was one of Colin Powell's right-hand men. And so, again, if indeed the full measure of the story about Pakistani involvement in September 11th were to come out, not only would it be very destructive to people's careers in Pakistan, but to hear as well. Before we move on, we're going to examine some more articles following up on the Dubai port controversy in just a second. We were talking in the first part of the program about Saudi economic and political influence in Lebanon and elsewhere in the Middle East. We've been talking here about Pakistan. a term that I have used in the past, and a term that has also been used by some mass media, in some cases I think incorrectly, that is the term Islamofascism. This has exposed a number of people, including to a certain extent yours truly, to charges of either academic shoddiness or even anti-Arab bigotry. We're going to review a piece of information that we've had in a number of broadcasts. It in turn comes from the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee, published in 1997, a book about the reemergence of fascism worldwide. And one of the things that we're going to look at is the way in which both the Saudis and their lavish funding of various projects in the Islamic world and the Pakistanis fit into a larger worldwide fascist milieu. That fascist milieu not only featured the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a man whose career stretched from service in the Turkish army in World War I, right on up through service with the SS in World War II, recruited many SS, Islamic SS units for the service of the Third Reich. He then worked throughout the post-war career, became the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, and ultimately his World Muslim Congress became the Islamic branch of the former World Anti-Communist League. Even included in this milieu is an American neo-Nazi, William Grimstead, who was hired by Saudi Arabia to be their Washington lobbyist. So when one hears charges of bigotry or intellectual unfairness being leveled at people who talk about Islamic fascism, now some of the right-wing talk show hosts, I think, do get way, way, way out of the base paths, but it is not intellectually dishonest, let alone bigoted, to talk about Islamofascism, because indeed, fascism in the Islamic world fits into, very effectively, a larger international fascist milieu. Turning to The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, when one thinks about Saudi and Pakistani influence, bear in mind how both the Saudi and Pakistani waters lap upon the same fascist shores. From The Beast Reawakens, another favorite speaker at the Institute for Historical Review, parenthetically a Holocaust denial institute and subsidiary of the Liberty Lobby, beginning again, another favorite IHR speaker and collaborator was Issa Naqlai of the World Muslim Congress, or WMC. Based in Pakistan, the WMC was initially headed by the Grand Mufti, who, like his friend H. Keith Thompson, stood by the Third Reich until his death in 1974. A few years later, the WMC, then headed by Pakistani Dr. Inamullah Khan, mailed Holocaust denial literature to every member of the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. The WMC's official mouthpiece, Muslim World, carried the ads for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Henry Ford's The International Jew. Dr. Khan's Congress also published Freemasonry, a book warning that Jews were using lodge members to extend secret control over religion and society, a paranoid theory that has long been popular among Liberty Lobby supporters and neo-Nazi groups around the world. Acknowledging their political kinship, WMC Secretary General Khan sent a letter to the Spotlight praising its, quote, superb in-depth analysis, unquote, and stating that the paper deserved, again quoting, the thanks of all right-minded people. Dr. Khan also served as an advisor to the Saudi Arabian royal family, which in turn lavished funds on the WMC. In addition, the Saudi Arabian government retained the services of American neo-Nazi William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist. Soon, the World Muslim Congress began working closely with U.S. intelligence and Pakistani military officials who were covertly supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. The effort was strongly endorsed by Dr. Khan, who served for many years as the Pakistani representative of the Nazi-infested World Anti-Communist League, which played an important role in the Reagan administration's secret war in the Golden Crescent. So again, that's part of how the Saudi and Pakistani establishments fit into a larger international fascist milieu. And if that ain't Islamofascism, I don't know what is. Now, we have covered the controversy surrounding the Dubai Ports acquisition. This would have enabled a Dubai-controlled company to assume a larger share of American port operations. Most importantly, it would have given them control over the actual containers themselves, the cargo containers. And as we looked at in For the Record 543, not only is there a considerable degree of al-Qaeda slash Islamist terrorist involvement with elements of the United Arab Emirates, but also one of the reasons why Dubai was the port of choice for many of the illicit nuclear technology shipments of the AQ Khan network is that containers shipped from Dubai cannot possibly be traced to their port of origin. Not something you want having happen in the United States, where only 5% or so of incoming cargo gets inspected. Well, apparently, even though the initial reports suggested that the deal would not go through, DP World, the Dubai company, is not apparently planning to sell its operations at the port of Miami. Now, Miami is, of course, not only a major drug importation center, bearing in mind some of the organized crime slash Islamist links that we looked at in Side 1. Miami is also, of course, in South Florida. It's in the same general area as the many things that we've looked at in connection with Daniel Hopsicker's investigations as well. I would also note that the way in which Atta and company were able to infiltrate the United States was apparently by operating on behalf of some of these controlled drug networks. Well, assuming you were a terrorist organization that wanted to get a weapon of mass destruction into the United States, shipping it into the port of Miami as part of a drug shipment might be a pretty good way of doing it, or perhaps flying it in. In an aircraft and a controlled drug route. Anyway, in connection with the Dubai port controversy and in light of the documented presence in the 911 investigative milieu of major protected drug smuggling elements, I think the following article is worth taking close note of. This is an AP article from March 13th of 2006. It was run in the Houston Chronicle under the title DP World, No Plan to Sell Miami Port Ops. It reads in part as follows. It's Dateline Washington, by the way. The Dubai-owned company that promised to surrender its U.S. port operations has no immediate plans to sell its U.S. subsidiaries' interests at Miami Seaport, a senior executive wrote Monday in a private email to business associates. Even if DP World were to sell its Miami operations to quell the congressional furor over an Arab-owned company managing major U.S. ports, quote, that would probably take a while, unquote, said Robert Scavone, a vice president for DP World's U.S. subsidiary. The email, obtained by the Associated Press, added to questions raised since DP World's announcement last week that it will divest U.S. port operations it acquired when it bought London-based Peninsular and Oriental Steam Navigation Company. DP World has said those operations are worth roughly $700 million. The takeover touched off a political uproar over the Bush administration's earlier approval of the deal without an intensive 45-day security investigation. The company initially sought to quiet the dispute by submitting voluntarily to such an investigation. So apparently, even with all the brouhaha, the DP World's Miami facilities will remain under their control. And in light of the extremely porous and organized crime ridden milieu that facilitated not only 9/11, but that is part of the financing structure of Islamist terrorism, that is a very discouraging awareness indeed. Now, one of the things that also has largely escaped people's notice here, may be that a much larger stake in the operations will be retained by Dubai. from the Financial Times of March 11th and 12th, and now there I've heard conflicting reports about this. This is by Robert Wright in London, headlined, Dubai may retain stake in U.S. assets. And apparently there was at least there was as of the beginning of last week, the possibility that it may be more than just the Miami facilities that remain under DP World's control. The article reads in part, Dubai's DP World is considering a variety of options for the U.S. business of P&O, including retaining a 49% stake in a new U.S.-based company running the operations. According to someone involved in the deal, DP World will consider retaining a stake and how large it might be once the group has sifted through a list of expressions of interest in the assets, which include the right to operate 5 key container terminals. Well, it remains to be seen what happens, but certainly if they're going to hang on to the Miami facility, it bodes ill. Who knows, the next Muhammad Atta perhaps riding a nuke like Chill Will, like Slim Pickens in Doctor Strangelove will come. He'll come a seaborne Muhammad Atta coming through the Miami port. Anyway, we'll see what happens. One of the things that is a major complicating factor in the whole question of terrorism, and that is the fact that in addition to organized crime networks, major above ground, major overworld business networks overlap the world of money from which Islamist terrorism nourishes itself. Indeed, as we've looked at and among other programs for the record 464 and 462, it was Osama bin Laden's Rolodex, so to speak, of funding sources for the Afghan Mujahideen movement that quickly catapulted him to the position he was in as a leader from the residua of the MAK, the Afghan Mujahideen. But one of the reasons why the Operation Green Quest investigation into terrorist financing withered on the vine was because some of the same networks involved in terrorist financing are also some of the same networks involved in major international corporate operations, including and especially those involved with the petroleum industry and related business interests. From the same Financial Times of London, this from Monday, March 11th and 12th, March 11th and 12th. The following article is by Rula Khalaf in London and William Wallace in Cairo. By the way, none other than Michael Chertoff, head of the Department of Homeland Security, has warned that getting too worried about things like the Dubai port deal could damage the U.S. economy. The following: intrusion of politics into business sours Arab trade ties. The Dubai Ports World debacle could cause lasting damage to Arab business ties with the U.S., despite the Emirates' decision to give up control of the 5 U.S. reports, according to analysts and businessmen in the Middle East. Officials in the United Arab Emirates, the federation that includes Dubai, said yesterday that the state-owned company's retreat in the face of U.S. congressional opposition was designed to protect the UAE's close relationship with the U.S. The decision was typical of a pro-Western Middle Eastern state that has traditionally avoided political controversy. Quote, "We did not want the ports issue to sour the ties between the UAE and the U.S. in any way," said a UAE official. And skipping down, "but that an investment by Dubai, the city-state seen in the region as an economic model, should face such a populist American backlash and cause a political storm in Washington has dismayed many Arab businessmen. At a time of economic boom in the region fueled by high oil prices, many businessmen are suggesting they would think twice before investing in the U.S. in the future." And note the following in that context. This from the London Independent of March 14th of 2006. Arab central banks move assets out of dollar. This is how you wage war, folks. By Philip Thornton, the Independent's economics correspondent, it reads in part, "Middle Eastern anger over the decision by the U.S. to block a Dubai company from buying 5 of its ports hit the dollar yesterday as a number of central banks said they were considering switching reserves into euros. The United Arab Emirates, which includes Dubai, said it was looking to move one-tenth of its dollar reserves into euros, while the governor of the Saudi Arabian Central Bank condemned the U.S. move as, quote, discrimination, unquote. Remember in this context that something we have not yet covered, but Iran is opening up an oil bourse, or is in the process of trying to open up an oil bourse, which will trade oil in euros, and which could therefore perhaps threaten the status of the dollar. One of the reasons it's the reserve currency of choice is because oil has been priced in dollars. Now, one of the United Arab Emirates and one of those stable countries that is friendly to the U.S. is the country of Qatar. Now, Qatar is the major focal point of the IG Farben-generated hydrogenation process, the resuscitation of which we looked at last week. So considering the looming economic importance of Qatar, consider the following and the fact that this technology, this predicted, at least by yours truly, resuscitation of elements of the hydrogenation process and the standard IG agreement, this is going to be taking place in Qatar. Reviewing from last week and from the Financial Times of Monday of March 6th of 2006, article by Thomas Caton in London, oil giants look to gas alternative. A novel way to create an ultra-clean fuel for cars that uses natural gas instead of oil is on the verge of rapid growth, analysts say, driven by soaring oil prices and a thirst for alternative fuels. Oil companies are investing billions of dollars in the nation technology called gas-to-liquids, or GTL, which can be used to produce quality diesel and a range of other products normally derived from crude. The process was developed in Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa, but in a few weeks will be tested on a commercial scale for the first time when the largest plant so far opens in Qatar. The Oryx GTL plant, a joint venture between South Africa's Sasol and Qatar Petroleum, is being watched closely by competitors and investors looking for the next big thing in energy. Skipping down, with the world's third largest gas reserves and a stable pro-Western leadership, Qatar is expected to attract about 70% of the investment in the sector and aspires to be, quote, the GTL capital of the world, unquote. Shell and ExxonMobil plan to build much larger GTL plants in Qatar. Of course, ExxonMobil, that's the old Standard Oil, which along with IG Farben was the generator of the Standard IG agreement focused on the hydrogenation process. Now, that article we read last week as part of For the Record 544. By way of capping off our discussion about the United Arab Emirates here and the most stable of those, Qatar, we're going to read another article from the Financial Times, this from May 19th of 2005, also by Thomas Caton. It's called Ambition to Become the World Capital of Novel Technology, Gas to Liquids. This firms up that the GTL process is a refinement of the hydrogenation process. The article reads in part, "To be sure, GTL has been around for a while. The basic process was invented in the 1920s and then developed by Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa, both of which had problems getting enough petrol for their vehicles. Initially, it was used to turn coal into a liquid. Today, it is used to turn natural gas into a clean-burning fuel for use in diesel engines, naphtha lubricants, and a range of other products." And again, initially, it was used to turn coal into a liquid. That is the old IG process, and apparently with the world's third largest natural gas reserves of Qatar, hopefully the most stable, of the United Arab Emirates is going to become the GTL capital of the world. That is the hydrogenation / IG Farben standard IG agreement capital of the world. In order to flesh out your understanding of the many topics I cover and the allusions that I make, that's A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N-S, by the way, do check out the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the linked websites, including and especially those of sister station WFMU, which is archiving the For the Record shows on. Basically has them all on file. By the way, there was a crash of their website, so a few of those have yet to be replaced. The ones that were damaged, they will be up in time. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 545, update on 9/11 and related matters. This is being recorded on March 19th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.